This is Ed Mazur, chairman of the City Club of Chicago. Our speaker at our initial meeting for 2018 is Kimberly Fox, the first African-American woman to lead the Cook County State's Attorney's Office, which happens to be the second largest prosecutor's office in the United States. State's Attorney Fox spent her early childhood growing up in the Cabrini Green public housing complex. She was raised by her teenage mother and grandmother, and she believes those experiences give her insights into the proper running of the Office of State's Attorney. One of her most recent accomplishments that she talks about is the first mass exoneration of falsely accused people in the history of Chicago and Cook County, referring to those individuals who were unjustly set up and arrested by disgraced Sergeant Ronald Watts. Fox said the office should be a powerful force for good, that the crisis of violence is the greatest challenge we face, and for the very first time in the history of her office, she has been holding monthly meetings with Superintendent Eddie Johnson of the Chicago Police Department and regular meetings with suburban police departments. The revamping of the office includes changing the gang unit into a new homicide unit, where vertical prosecution is followed from the beginning to the very top. She believes that public safety and criminal justice are not diametric opposites, and she has spent a lot of time reaching out to partners outside of law enforcement in the area of mental health, education, various community organizations. Fox has led the fight to lower cash bonds and revise the bond system. She thinks this is going to be very important, ensuring that all people, poor as well as the rich, are treated equally in the criminal justice system. Since she's been in office, the Conviction Integrity Unit has seen a 500% increase in questions from people who are incarcerated. She's increased transparency and will be announcing in the next couple of weeks the release of data that has never been made public to the public before. Superintendent Kim Fox received an overwhelming round of applause from the audience for answering some very, very tough questions.
Ladies and gentlemen, Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle. Madam President,
good afternoon. I'm very grateful for the chance to introduce Kim today, but before I do that, I want to acknowledge another former chief of staff who's also at our table, Kurt Summers, treasurer of the City of Chicago. Thank you for joining us, Kurt. So as most of you know, Kim spent a couple years in my office as deputy chief of staff and chief of staff, and I'm grateful for her service in that capacity and proud of the work that she's doing as state's attorney in Cook County. I want to read something that made me particularly proud. In November of 2017, this is a story from the Sun-Times, November 17th. A Cook County judge Thursday vacated felony convictions for 15 defendants who claimed they were framed by disgraced Chicago Police Sergeant Ron Watts following a landmark decision by the state's attorney's office to toss aside a string of cases over allegations of police misconduct. With 10 defendants standing in the courtroom, Chief Criminal Court Judge Leroy Martin approved a motion by prosecutors to throw out a total of 18 cases against 15 men who were arrested by Watts and members of the tactical unit that he headed that operated in Ida B. Wells housing projects. After the hearing, attorney Joshua Tepfer said the move by the state's attorney marked the first mass exoneration in the history of Cook County. It's an extraordinary sign of what's going on in the county and in this city that we have a crucial law enforcement entity, or I would say officer, take this step and overturn all these convictions in recognition of a systemic problem of police corruption. Now, these, of course, aren't the first individuals to be framed by Chicago police officers. They won't be the last. But I am very grateful to Kim for her willingness to take on these difficult cases, to acknowledge the mistakes of the past, and do our best to address and correct them. Please welcome her warmly.
Good afternoon. It feels weird doing it after Tony. Good afternoon. Thank you so much for that introduction, Tony. Thank you all for assembling today. When Jay asked if I would be willing to come and give this speech today, I thought it's January 8th, it's right after the new year, not much would be happening, and then I have to follow Oprah's iconic speech yesterday. So here we go. Again, thank you all so much for this opportunity. I was last here speaking at the 100-day mark of my term in office, and it has been quite a remarkable time period since the time I was sworn in that first 100 days. I sought this office, as I said, on the campaign trail and continue throughout my tenure because I believe in its potential to be a powerful force for good. And I stand here today excited and invigorated by the path that we're charting for the years ahead. Of course, as a prosecutor, my primary challenge and my greatest priority is protecting public safety. We are all too familiar with the harrowing statistics about shootings and homicides in the city of Chicago and the staggering number of guns in our streets that can start to feel like an unchangeable fact of life for many of our neighborhoods. We cannot underestimate the toll that these stark numbers takes on the human beings who are impacted. And the circle of human beings impacted is vast, wider than we'd sometimes like to think. It is not only victims, but their families, neighbors, the children who suddenly have an empty seat in their classroom next to them, the physicians who see an endless stream of trauma cases, and the people who, as these stories pile up, wonder whether the great city of Chicago is really a place they want to live after all. This crisis and this trauma weighs on all of us. It weighs on me heavily. There's no greater challenge that we must all rise up to meet than addressing the crisis of violence. And I think we are all sophisticated enough to recognize that meeting this task cannot be achieved by law enforcement or my office alone. I reject the premise, and I reject it wholeheartedly, that you can either have criminal justice reform or public safety, but not both. I am deeply committed to working in partnership with law enforcement to address violent crime and the chokehold that it has on so many of our communities. And I'm equally committed to being in partnership with communities and community organizations who are working on the ground to address social service needs and to work with our young people to attempt to stem this tide and intervene with young people before they become involved in violence. We can and we must do both. I'm grateful to Superintendent Eddie Johnson and Chicago Police Department for the partnerships that we've been building during the course of my tenure between our offices to be as sophisticated and as effective as possible in addressing violent crime. We are, for the first time in our office history, meeting on a monthly basis with the Chicago Police Department to share data about gun prosecutions and to work together to identify opportunities to improve prosecution of those cases. We have convened a working group with our partners in suburban law enforcement, meeting regularly to discuss issues and collaborate on solutions. And we are employing proven prosecution strategies designed to maximize our effectiveness in addressing gun crimes and homicides. In partnership with the CPD, we are also embedding prosecutors, dedicated prosecutors, in the most violent Chicago police districts as part of a new intelligence-driven prosecution model, building strong cases against the small number of offenders who are driving the most violence. And we have reformed our gangs unit into what we've called now our homicide unit that vertically prosecutes cases. What that means is that the same team of prosecutors handles a case from the beginning of the case, from the charging decision, all the way to the end, to ensure continuity for victims and to build the deepest expertise possible in these cases. When violent crime occurs, we must bring all of our resources that we have to bear to those cases and seek justice. The crisis in the city of Chicago with violence demands nothing less. But as we work to address violence, we must also not lose sight of the bigger picture. My decision to run for state's attorney came from a deep belief in the power of this office to be a force for public safety and justice, but also from a recognition that too often in our criminal justice system, justice has meant prosecuting as many cases as possible. I sought this office because I believe fundamentally that it is the responsibility of the prosecutor's office to take a broader view, to recognize the constellation of social factors that bring people into contact with our criminal justice system, to see how our systems and practices have disproportionately impacted people of color and people who are poor, and to rigorously evaluate what it means to really make us safer or to provide meaningful justice to victims of crime. We should not be surprised in this room or anywhere when a drug addict's short stay in the Illinois Department of Corrections fails to solve their addiction, or when an overnight stay in the Cook County Jail destabilizes rather than cures the person who desperately needs medication and consistent mental health care that just isn't available. As prosecutors, to do real justice, we must understand that substance abuse issues that drive so many of our property crimes, we must understand and acknowledge that. That the behavioral health issues that underlie repeated and frequent contact with law enforcement, where what they really need is treatment. And the community disenfranchisement that makes legitimate employment seem unattainable to so many, particularly our young people. And to be clear, these factors do not excuse criminal behavior, but the failure to appreciate them hinders our ability to adequately address the conduct and ensure that it doesn't happen again. That's why we've undertaken a full review of our alternative prosecution, diversion, and treatment court programs to look at what is working, how we can maximize our eligibility for these programs, and fill the gaps where we find them. The broad array of social factors at work here commands that we have strong partners. Again, I reiterate that the work that we do requires us to have partners outside of law enforcement, with our friends who work in community advocacy, our friends who work in mental health, substance abuse treatment, economic development, and education. We need to work collaboratively. We are deeply concerned about the stories, for example, of juveniles who commit violent crimes. But too often we fail to recognize that these stories are the tragic end, not the beginning, of a long road of warning signs. We must be better at connecting the threads of information about our young people and connecting and building a truly supportive safety net that intervenes before the point of contact with the justice system. But it's not just about intervention. As prosecutors, we must also recognize that the vast majority of the people who we convict, who are incarcerated will eventually come back out and come back to the same communities and oftentimes the very same households and plan for their service needs. We must plan for their return and find services and employment needs and economic opportunity when they do. If not, we will continue to see the cycles that we've endured. And I say everywhere I go, this is very personal to me. I am very open about sharing my personal story. As Oprah said, speak your truth. And I have been unwavering in speaking my truth about being a girl who grew up in the projects, about being the victim of violent crime and experiencing homelessness. I do that because it is my proximity to these issues, my very personal experiences seeing the impact that these systems have on our communities, that actually makes me better at this job. And we must all keep that big picture in mind as we undertake this work. So let me take a minute to talk a little more concretely about some of these principles in action. Doing this work means that we have to make difficult choices among competing priorities with limited resources. As we make these choices, a key principle has been that the criminal justice system should not be a financial-based enterprise and should not punish people for being poor. In my first year of office, we have deliberately said we will not spend as many of our limited resources on what are, in effect, financial-based offenses. Whether it's raising the threshold for approving felony charges for retail theft to $1,000, more in line with our neighbors, or declining to prosecute misdemeanor driving offenses for failure to pay parking ticket or other fines. I can tell you today that those efforts are making a difference. In 2017, the number of people charged with a felony instead of a misdemeanor for retail theft has dropped significantly. That means fewer people are spending years in prison for low-level retail theft. As we work to address the unfair impact our system has on people who are poor, perhaps our most significant progress has been addressing the injustices of a cash-based bond system that has historically detained thousands of people per year while they await trial, having not yet been found guilty, simply because they have the inability to pay a cash bond, often in as little amounts as a few hundred dollars. There have been discussions about the need for bond reform occurring in Cook County for years. And President Preckwinkle is to be commended for those efforts in leading the charge. But the state's attorney's office had been historically absent from those conversations. Since I took office, we turned that on its head in two ways. First, we began working with the Public Defender's Office, and I'm so grateful for the partnership that we've had with Amy Campanelli, to file motions for agreed I-bonds in cases where people were in jail on bonds of $1,000 or less, allowing for their release without having to put up cash. Then, we worked with the leadership in our Criminal Prosecutions Bureau to identify circumstances in which pretrial release should be the norm and instructed our attorneys in bond court to start recommending I-bonds in those cases. To say this was a new way of doing things in our office is an understatement, and I hear the people from my office giggling. And candidly, actually, we learned a lot in the process about how to engage our partners and our attorneys in the process of developing new policies. But the actions taken by our office have coincided with a major acceleration in the bond reform process, resulting in a new order issued by Chief Judge Timothy Evans, instructing judges to only use cash bonds only as a last resort and only in the amounts that the defendant is able to pay. It is not an exaggeration, to say the least, that this is truly a sea change in the pretrial practices in the Cook County criminal justice system. You can clap. Yeah. Rethinking what it means to do justice in Cook County also means that we must build credibility and legitimacy of this office by rigorously investigating claims of wrongful convictions and righting old wrongs. We have hired a new director of our Conviction Integrity Unit, Mark Rodert, who is here today. You can stand up, Mark, so they know who you are. And Mark and his team have developed a first-of-its-kind protocols to bring clarity and transparency to the work of reviewing wrongful conviction claims. Already, already, jurisdictions from around the country are seeking to learn from these efforts and are adopting similar protocols for their own offices. One of the most staggering statistics from our first year is that the Conviction Integrity Unit has seen a 500% increase in requests for review. 500%. And I can take from that the confidence that they have that we will look at these cases seriously. And I think it is, again, a clear indication that the influx is a direct result of the work that we are doing to diligently review and investigate these cases and to move promptly to address these findings. Beginning just 2 weeks, or just weeks into my tenure, we dismissed charges in the Marquette Park 4 case. Through our most recent dismissal, as the president alluded to, of 15 old narcotics cases stemming from the work of a disgraced Chicago police officer. There were, in many instances, some that were considered small cases, peoples whose sentences were long complete. But we recognize the adverse effect that even an old conviction can have on one person's ability to move on and lead a productive life. And I'm so very proud of the work that our Conviction Integrity Unit has done in these cases, both large and small. Switching gears, I'd like to take a moment to discuss how we've been breaking new ground in our civil practice. In addition to being the chief law enforcement officer, the chief prosecutor for Cook County, we are also the county's lawyer, representing the interests of the people of Cook County in civil litigation. This often overlooked part of our work is emerging as an innovative partner in attacking some of our most pressing social issues and advocating on behalf of the people of Cook County. We've been active partners in the fight to defend the county's fair and welcoming county ordinance, challenging federal immigration policies that seek to improperly co-opt local authorities to engage in immigration enforcement. Our work of prosecuting crime does not work if our communities feel afraid to come forward. And this work is an important step to support the work on our criminal side of the office. And in an unprecedented move for this office, we have also filed two major proactive lawsuits against corporations in the last month. One, suing opioid manufacturers for their role in actively promoting unsafe use of prescription opioids in ways that have fueled our mounting drug crisis. And additionally, one against Uber for its data breach that left personally identifying information of millions of consumers here in Cook County vulnerable to hacking, placing them at risk for identity theft. We are fully committed to using every tool at our disposal to protect and advocate on behalf of the people of Cook County. And work like our opioid lawsuit is an important complement to our criminal work, where we see the crippling impact on the opioid crisis is having on our communities, often tragically contributing to crimes committed in service of that addiction. As we undertake this work, I am acutely aware that our success depends on not only the work in our courtrooms, but how we communicate that work to the public. Prosecutors' offices are not historically known, as paragons of openness, laughs the public defenders. And there are many things. Factual details of cases, identities of victims and witnesses, deliberative processes of our attorneys that are appropriately kept confidential. But when I sought this office, I did so committed to the principle that the public has a right to know and understand the broader trends and patterns in the work that we do. And I am extremely proud of the work we have done in this space in our first year. We released our first ever data report in late 2017, based on 2016 data, which provides an important snapshot of the work of our office. We also released the data sets that were used in the creation of that report so that you, the public, can check our work. And this was just the first step. In November, we brought on our first ever chief data officer, a role that reports to me directly. Their job is to ensure that our work is driven by data and not by anecdote, and to push us to measure our work in metrics and not by war stories. We will be releasing an updated data report next month with the 2017 data, and we're building towards an expansive and user-friendly release of several years' worth of data on the Cook County Open Data Portal. Thank you. And our new Chief Data Officer is also here today, Matthew Saney, if you could stand up. I truly believe with Matthew and the team that we've assembled that we are positioned to be a leader in the country on transparency in the prosecutor's office. And I'm excited about the work that we have ahead. And this matters not just because I like pretty charts, and as my team will tell you, I do. I understand that at a visceral level, and we should all understand that, that the skepticism and wariness that so many of our communities feel when it comes to our criminal justice system, we must understand that, as my mother would say, we have to show and prove. And the only way we're going to combat and build that trust is being open and candid. I do not expect that the public will always understand or agree with the decisions that I make. This work is difficult. It is incredibly difficult. These decisions are hard, but it is my duty as the holder of this office which holds so many cards and has so much power within the system, to be forthright about our work and to engage with people in meaningful and respectful ways, even when we disagree. And as I stand here 1 year into my term, I am profoundly grateful for the men and women who work for this office, who have dedicated their careers to public service because they believe in advocating for the people of Cook County. And if we can take one moment to have the staff of the Cook County State's Attorney's Office to be recognized for the tremendous work that they do. I love that the people in the front were like, don't make us stand, while the people in the back were like, hey, us back here. We appreciate all of you, standers and sitters alike. And the people of Cook County, you could not be in better hands than the men and women who represent your interests every day in our court system. I ran for this office because I believe we can and we must do better. We must do better. And as we continue to grow in our work and act on this broader vision of justice, I am grateful for their service, I am grateful for your support, and I am excited and driven about the work that still lies ahead. Thank you so very, very much. Now they stand.
Thank you very much, State's Attorney Fox. And we want to make this an annual affair. This is like your state of your office. You came here a year ago, actually 90 days into your office and a year ago. And this year, and we expect to see you back here again next year.
Thank you.
We have a few questions, as we always do here at the City Club. Will try to answer as many of these as we can. This is from City Club member Steve Brenner. He wants to know if it would be better policy to release video of alleged crimes after a jury is selected. If the video is released before a trial, doesn't that possibly inflame the public and taint the jury pool? Interesting question.
It is an interesting question. So the release of video, at least law enforcement video, by Chicago Police Department in particular, is a policy that is the policy of the city. It is not a state's attorney policy. It's not a law enforcement policy. Certainly, our belief is that the integrity of our cases, the integrity of our prosecutions, require that we release evidence, and video can sometimes be evidence, at a time appropriate so that it does not jeopardize the integrity of our cases. However, as I indicated, I mean, that is our preference. That is, I think, what makes good law enforcement. However, these policies are not policies that have been enacted by the state's attorney's office.
Okay, thank you. This is from City Club member Ashvin Ladd. He'd like to know what criteria your office uses by the Convictions Integrity Unit as to what cases they're going to review and pursue. And is there a time frame for reviewing and pursuing?
Certainly. So our Conviction Integrity Unit investigates cases of where we're looking at actual innocence. So there are two different paths, and I apologize for being all lawyerly, that you can go in looking at old cases. There's our post-conviction unit that looks at the history of the case, and was there something that happened in the process and procedures of that case that should have the case reviewed. Our conviction integrity does is this a case of actual innocence? Is the wrong person being locked up for a crime in which they did not commit? And so one of the things that we have done is we've laid out the protocol and practices for how we evaluate those cases so that there isn't a hit or miss process. So we have online for the first time what are the criteria for having our cases reviewed. We also have online an application by which people can download and process. One of the other things that we did, which I was very pleased with Mark and his team, was created packets that we sent down to the prisons throughout the state of Illinois so that those who are currently incarcerated who may not have access to computers and not have access to the internet can have that material at their availability and send it back to us. We believe that having that information in the hands of those who actually need it is rather critical. And again, if you want to see the specific criteria, we have it up on our website, again, so that we are transparent with the public.
Thank you very much. Now, you notice we have two forms up here. We have blue form and we have some white question forms. In the interest of transparency, the white forms are people who could not be here today but have submitted questions to us electronically. This is from Jamie Joyce with Local Legend Films. Her question: how do you see restorative justice playing a part in the future of Chicago's criminal justice system?
So very quickly, for those who don't know what restorative justice is, it's a philosophy where you look at the person who has committed the harm and the person who has been harmed, and how do we basically make them whole? It is the recognition that the person who has committed the harm has the potential to be made whole. And it is also the recognition that the person who has been harmed benefits by that as well, and that we do what is necessary for them so that they can feel that justice has been served. It's a process that is not new to Cook County. In fact, it is our guiding principle in our juvenile court system, and it is a model that is being expanded across the country into our adult system as well. So I believe that there has been enough basically test work of restorative justice practices in Cook County on the juvenile level and enough rigorous evaluation to determine that it has merit and impact that we can engage and should engage in our adult criminal justice system about using restorative justice. I believe in restorative justice principles and practices.
Okay, thank you. This is from Linda Foreman, City Club member. Since training and employment are key to rehabilitation, what partnerships with businesses do you have or would you like to have?
We would like to have those partnerships. During this my tenure, I have gone out and met with a number of small business organizations to talk about the role that the business community has in criminal justice. I know I will sound like a broken record where I say that we can't do this alone, But the importance of economic stability cannot be underestimated in talking about driving down crime. If you leave with nothing else today, dispel the notion that a lot of our crime is driven by bad people doing bad things who are unrehabilitable. You have to dispel yourself of that. We have the most violence-prone neighborhoods in our city are also the same neighborhoods who have the highest levels of unemployment. They have the highest levels of disinvestment. And so it's not coincidental. If we do not have mechanisms by which people can be engaged in the economy by working, we're going to keep playing whack-a-mole with our justice system. And so we are looking for those partnerships. So perhaps as we expand diversion, how do we get someone to engage in perhaps an apprenticeship type program, to engage in a work program, to get those skills and development that they need to be productive? And that requires, again, a commitment from the business community to work with us and to work with the population that historically we've turned our backs against. Again, as a prosecutor, I cannot tell you how vitally it is important for us to look at reentry and look at ways to ensure that folks who come out of our justice system are able to come back in and be productive as a way for crime prevention.
Thank you. One of the points that you mentioned, State's Attorney, was that the reduction in I-bonds and making the bond be affordable as much as... What sort of reaction, if any, have you had from, let's say, business owners in the communities that have been robbed, burglarized, attacked to this kind of reaction? Since so many of the people who are incarcerated, once they're let go, tend to come back to the communities where their alleged original crimes occurred.
I mean, I think it's really important when we have the conversation about bond that we do in education, the difference between jails and prisons. Jails, the Cook County Jail, the place at 26 in California, is where people go who are awaiting trial. And one of the basic premises of our criminal justice system or American jurisprudence is innocent until proven guilty. So when we're talking about bond, we're talking about people who are not yet convicted of a crime. What we know, why the conversation around bond reform matters, is that we know that prolonged pretrial detention has not the effect that we think, that it's going to make us safer. In fact, it is destabilizing. So part of what we've had to do is educate the community, our business partners, about what the purpose of bond is. We should also note that people who are dangerous and dangerous to the community ought not be able to walk out of jail despite their danger because they are rich. That doesn't make us safer either. So what we're saying to business communities and those who have maybe not delved down into the policy issues of criminal justice is partner with us. Because again, from a restorative justice model, most business owners don't want people stealing from them. If you tell a business owner that a significant portion of their tax dollars are going to maintaining a complex at 26 in California to the tune of $500 million a year, or a criminal justice system in the state that has a recidivism rate of 55%, from a business model perspective, that's not good business when your return rate is failure more than it is success. So how do we work together to build a more successful model? What we try to tell people is that we cannot cling to old notions of what safety looks like. And business owners who I've spoken with are excited about the potential of sharing what they know, having worked in business and working with the justice system to have better outcomes, because a 55% recidivism rate for people who are returning to our jails within 3 years indicates that something is not working right.
Very good. Terrific. This one probably isn't as complicated. This is from LaShawn James with Addis Healthcare. Can you touch on senior services that your office provides?
Certainly. Our office has a unit, Seniors and Persons with Disabilities, that works specifically with those who are of advanced age or who have disabilities. As you can well imagine, that they are a vulnerable population who are sometimes subjected to scams and other forms of abuse. And so we have a dedicated unit that deals with everything from, again, consumer fraud scams to those who do white-collar crimes where they may take over their checks or things of that nature to ensure that their rights are being protected. But we have a dedicated unit for seniors and persons with disabilities.
Okay, we have time for two last questions. One, there have been a number of carjackings and crimes like that. And I believe Superintendent Johnson has indicated that it may be time to revisit the definition of juvenile and non-juvenile in some of these areas when it comes to charges and that. Do you have any thoughts on this issue?
On carjackings in particular or juvenile?
Well, crimes committed by juveniles. But when it comes to charging them, I think he alluded
to
the fact.
So, yes, I got it. I think my team is looking at me. I think we have to be incredibly careful when we're talking about criminal justice policy. I think what we have seen in the course of the last several decades is reactionary policy after something happens. And we usually name the law after somebody because something has happened. And for my legislative friends who are down in Springfield, know that then we have to have a law that combats that. What we know as the first juvenile court in the world is that children are different than adults. What we know based on scientific research and evidence and history is that they are different than adults. What we also know is that our responses to them have to be particular to their needs. And we cannot, in a moment of fervor and fear, reject sound notions in science for political expediency.
One last question, and then we'll have our drawing. This is from Jennifer Alexander with the Metropolitan Family Services. What would you identify as your greatest professional accomplishment thus far since being elected? It's that Oprah moment.
What? Sorry. Wow, I'm stumped because I think people see the work that happens when news cameras catch it, when there's a big story or a headline that's written about something that we've done. Obviously, the reversal of the convictions of the men under the Watts cases gets a lot of attention. But it is really every day going into an office where the decision to not charge is happening, where before you thought that you could not give someone an opportunity, or you couldn't think outside of the box with the restorative justice practice, or coming to say, listen, I want us to be able to engage in this way. And so for me, I can't pin it on one thing. It's been such an honor and a privilege to have served in that office for 12 years, to come back and work with such a tremendous team who does the work and show up every day, and they are not getting paid very well. And they worry about their job stability. And every day they sit and take on some of the ugliest things that this county has ever seen, and they do it with such grace and integrity. And they have the willingness to say, we want to do our jobs better. And so for me, the professional accomplishment is that I get to serve alongside them, and they believe in that leadership, and that we are trying to be the best, most transparent office and professional office in the country. And that level of commitment by my team is what I am most proud of.
Whoa.